You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6:59. Coming up next, Hard Knock Radio.
Hi, this is John Shuck, host of Progressive Spirit. What do palm fronds, eagle feathers, and Ganesh statues have in common?
What about religious practices generally that harm the environment?
Law professor Jay Wexler is seeking a balance between religion and care for Earth. His new book is called When God Isn't Green. Listen to weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/progressive spirit.
It's the little things we take for granted when we sacrifice to save the planet.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO at the Clinton will show Who Are My People? Who Are My People is a documentary film which follows four Native American elders as they seek to preserve cultural resources, including large geoglyphs from the building of renewable energy facilities in California's Mojave Desert. Director Robert Lundahl will be in attendance. Again, that's Who Are My People, Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
What's up, fam? You're tuned to Hard Knock. On today's program, we bring you Dr. Joy DeGruy on post-traumatic slave syndrome. Stay tuned.
A soldier passes, Abdul Majid.
Political prisoner here in the state of New York, and I just want to give a shout out to brothers and sisters that are locked down, and particularly Jamil Alameen, Matulu Shakur, Sekou Odinga. Brothers out there on the West Coast, Rochelle McGee, Chip, Hugo, Brother Lenny Patel. Brothers, stay strong and keep Sister Asada Shakur free by any means necessary. All power to the people. Assalamu alaikum.
His name was Abdul Majid, and in his youth, he soldiered for the Black Panther Party in New York. When he was arrested in 1982, he was beaten badly and charged in the April 1981 shootout with a cop. He and his colleague, Black Panther Bashir Hamid, were tried three times before a conviction was returned. They were known as the Queen's Two, black revolutionary political prisoners of the state. Although it took three juries to return guilty pleas, the men continued to struggle against their imprisonment. That final jury, by the way, was obtained by the exclusion of black jurors from the panel. Abdul Majid was known during his radical youth as an organizer for the Ocean Hill Brownsville Tenants Association in Brooklyn, New York, working for the people. Abdul Majid, after 33 plus years in a prison cell, has returned to his fathers. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yo,
This is M1 from Dead Press.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from The Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten-ass system.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop.
Peace and love. This is Azeem. You're listening to Hard Knock Radio. Real radio. From the concrete up. All the way to the sun. Keep shining, y'all. One love.
What's up, folks? This is your girl Femi representing the whole Bay Area. I'm here on Hard Knock Radio. News, views, and hip-hop. Stay tuned.
And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock. Now, here's Dr. Joy DeGruy.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to balance this a bit. And get the, because you all who have heard it know that we can't get into part two with people not understanding part one. Am I telling the truth? So it's just the way it is. It's thick. This is thick material, which we shouldn't be receiving like this, but this is how it is. Okay. So first hour is going to be devoted to an overview for those of you that have been here right in the middle, wherever I stop, you know, you got to read the book. Those of you that don't know, and then I'll talk a little bit more about how you apply this information as it relates to our work currently with communities of color and particularly African Americans. So we start with sort of like, for those of you that are new, a kind of a fundamental understanding about post-traumatic. Post-traumatic slave syndrome is exactly what it sounds like. It's looking at the concept of multi-generational trauma. Now, the average person, including black people, that will actually hear post-traumatic slave syndrome and not want to come. They don't even want to, they go, oh, because they start getting worried about what white people are going to think when you say slavery. If slavery's in the title, black people start getting nervous about what white people are going to say. And it's a very interesting sociological reality, because we start realizing that what's going to happen is you're going to get pushback, right? You're going to hear people going, oh, are they gonna, she's not gonna talk, slavery? Are you really? You gonna talk about slavery? Aren't y'all free now? I mean, really, I mean, come on now. You know how long ago slavery, I mean, who are you trying to blame? You know, what excuses are you people trying to come up with? I wasn't there, okay? I didn't own slaves. I mean, people get all twisted when you say that. And the reason for that is kind of part of how my research got started, because I thought that was a curious thing, because multi-generational trauma is not new, and looking at it is not new. Intergenerational trauma, intergenerational transmission of trauma, none of that's new. We've looked at all kinds of different groups, Native Americans and the impact of colonialism, unresolved grief. We've looked at Aboriginal folks in Australia. We've looked at victims of war. Then why is there the pushback when I say slavery? Why is there not the same pushback when I say Holocaust? Because you see, we're really talking about the same thing. The only difference is we're talking about black people. And what's interesting about that is, again, I teach a 10-week course, which is, it's if you go online and go on Portland, say, you'll see my syllabus, you'll see the explanation of the course, you'll see the title of my book, and I tell people, this is about black people. I want to be clear about that. I'm not apologizing that I'm only going to talk about black people. I'm not going to talk about anybody else. I have to tell my students, I'm going to show up black next week. The week after that, it's going to be about black people. The week after that, it's going to be about black people. Every single week. And inevitably, there's a student that goes, it's in the little evaluation. The professor spent an inordinate amount of time talking about black people. And it feels unnatural that you should talk that much about. Do you know how much? I have 3 advanced degrees, right? 2 master's degrees and a PhD, a bachelor's degree, and then the whole load of nut crazy stuff I went through elementary, middle, and high school with, and all of it was about white people. But somehow it just feels so unnatural to be talking that much about black people. A whole 10 weeks, imagine that, right? So when again, but it feels, because of the way we've been socialized in this country, that that's just too much time to be talking about black people, right? And the bottom line is we've never had the conversation, you see. So that's why black people start getting uncomfortable and start looking in the room at the white people and going, is she making the white people uncomfortable? Heaven, heaven forbid the white people. And if Cindy cries, what are we gonna do? What are we gonna do, right? And it's that, my whole life it's been that way. One person, you've given a whole lecture, years of research, and one person raises their hands from, you know, somewhere out in Arkansas and says, are you sure? Because I'm feeling like I've never experienced this and I'm feeling uncomfortable. I feel like, you know, people are calling me a racist. And then she cries and then the whole thing gets disrupted because of that, right? And the bottom line is I have walked through the world in this skin. Aside from having all of the scholarship, I've walked 55 years in this skin. And that gives me a certain legitimacy about myself. Right? And it's just a real interesting common sense thing. But, you know, I've had people say, oh, I know all about you people. I have a minor in degree in black studies. I know all about you. Right? Amazing. Anyway, so that said, when we begin to look at the conversation about race, there are certain things I do to clear out my room. I just want to thin the course. I want to thin it out so that the people that end up in my class want to be there. I said, this is not the class to take to fit into your program. You go, oh God, this is a good time. I'll put that one in. Not the class. My course is a life-changing course. It truly is a life. And I don't mean that because I have some, you know, it's really the truth. You don't leave the same if you've been 10 weeks in my course. And so I tell them, don't squeeze it in. It's not that kind of course. And then I explain to them that it's not one of those things where, you know, we all walk in this room at the same level. There are those of you that walked in this program at what we call the 600 level, having never entered a classroom, having never had any kinds of, you know, scholarship around it, but having lived in skin that suggested you were a bit different. People of color walked into this room at the 600 level because they've lived in that skin. That's just a fact, okay? And they get to have that. Then there are people who walk in this room, good, well-meaning, good hearts, interested, curious, 101. They're at the level 101. There's nothing wrong with 101. I don't teach it, however. I don't teach 101. I think it's valid. It's a prerequisite. But they, you know, people thought, and again, sometimes people go, well, isn't there a black woman teaching? It doesn't matter, because if anybody black teaching, I can handle it. There are folks that believe that it could not be above my head, right? So there's a person that comes in 101 that has a different concept of race, race relationships, and racism. And they're the ones that are going, are you sure? Isn't it all better now? After all, you have a black president. You have them. They're in here too. And they're seated next to someone that wants to talk about reparations. So therein lies the problem of the speaker, because I got to keep everybody in the room safe and comfortable, right? So it's a task. And again, it's not my intent to make anyone feel uncomfortable. The nature of this material is intense. It's going to be even more intense because I have to condense it. But I want to be very clear about the problems that are associated with this and why this room is so filled today, because we're a hot mess in this country around race. We're a hot mess. So we have to have the conversation. So when we begin the conversation, we have to start figuring out where we are. So I thin my room by asking a couple of fundamental questions. So the first question I ask is, are we all on the same page when we say racism? Right? So we say racism, right? And this is a system of advantage based on race. Rolls off the lips. It seems pretty straightforward. I think I have that up here somewhere. Let's see, where is it? No, I'm going to go back. So we go back to, these are my warm and fuzzy pick things that I do. I do a warm and fuzzy just so people know that I'm not, you know, because folks get very upset and concerned. I really have a fundamental belief that part of our problem as human beings is we don't really see ourselves as fully human. And our lack of humanity is why we have the problems we have. I really do believe, like Einstein said in this statement, that we are all just intrinsically connected. We are connected to each other. Everything is connected. And that's what Einstein believed and was able to prove to some degree. On a cellular level, we are connected. And that our problem is we suffer a delusion of separateness, and that's what makes for the crazy stuff. Okay? So I believe fundamentally that we are connected, and our refusal to accept that is the reason why we're seeing the disintegration in our cultures and our societies, is we have to realize that we are we're a globe. This is a global reality. We can't even guess who's coming to dinner now. Because our children, my 2-year-old granddaughter can navigate, you know, the internet and talk to somebody in China and literally develop a relationship with someone on the other side of the world. So her world is not shrunk into a living room. Her world is global. And if we keep treating our children like this is just, you know, you're this singular, separate thing, it's just not going to work. We've got to start figuring out we are one world, and that's the truth. But we can't act like a world because we've been socialized to believe the myths and the lies. So the very first, principle upon which I live and breathe is the principle of truth. Truthfulness, I believe, is the foundation of all human virtue. If you are not truthful, you are not going to be a healthy person. It is the secrets that make us sick. My years of clinical work has proven it. My 55 years in this skin has taught me that. So we have to start telling the truth, and sometimes the truth is not easily heard. One of the truths that we have to deal with is the fact that the majority of the world is indeed a world of color. Of the 7+ billion people on the planet, the majority of those people are people of color. That's a fact, right? And so now that we are a globe, it's inevitable that we're going to see audiences that look more like this one than the solitary, single, separated systems that we have lived under in the past. And for some folks, that creates problems because people start worrying about the blending. And the worry about the blending existed for many, many years. And the truth is, if you just look at it, just you looked at everybody in this room and you blended them all up, in the future, people will be the color of ripened wheat. That's the future. Whatever we want to do or believe, that's the future. And so we have to begin to deal with numbers. Some people like numbers. So these are numbers, and they're real numbers. And as long as people have been able to keep themselves separated, they can't anymore. So when we think about who we are, wonderful statement from Gandhi. I really believe this because it plays out in everyone's life. Your beliefs become your thoughts. Thoughts become your words. Words become your actions. Actions become your habits. Habits become your values. Your values become your destiny. What do we value? I believe that we don't value our humanity, which is the reason why it's so difficult for us to deal with this issue of race and racism and justice and equity, any of those, because we are not willing to see the intrinsic value in all people. Everyone has been born with the right to be treated with respect and dignity. That's not something that must be earned. We were all born deserving that. And if we really, truly believe that, then we'll see it exercised in our lives. So the first chapter in my book is called I Don't Even Notice Race. And I did that because people have actually said that to me, in a way trying to compliment me. Joy, you know what? I don't even notice that you're black. I find that odd because I do. Every single day I look in the mirror, black woman, surely, there she is, every day, black woman. I'm not confused about it. Why should anyone else be confused? And then as a social scientist and a clinician, the first thing that resonates with me is that's not a true statement. It's just not true. That's number one, it's not true. I don't notice race. Nothing true about that statement. And if you ever want to really test if people are telling the truth. This is so amazing. Although that's on face value is not true. And the reason why that's not true on face value is because The people who say that to you are usually white people. And they only say it to the people they notice. I'm just saying. They don't say it to other white people. You know what I'm saying? I'm just... And so then the second question is, why would you feel like you needed to say that? I don't even notice that you're black. That's not a compliment to me. I'm not interested in you erasing me in order to be able to feel comfortable with yourself. I need you to be able to see me, right? But erasing you is somehow a compliment that, you know, your blackness really, I'm not noticing it. Right? Now, the two people in the group, at least in my experience, that tend to tell the truth more frequently than others, two groups. Little children. The little ones, right? The little ones that you just hope that don't get in the room before you. That crew. About 3 1/2. My perfect favorite age is 3 1/2 because they have opinions. And they're the few people in the world that you can rely on that will tell you when you have a booger. Your best friend will let you go all day with that booger. But a 3-year-old will go, you got a booger in your nose. They'll tell you. And see, old people tell you too, because see, old people, you stop caring. Anybody 50 and above? If you're 50 and above, raise your hand. Isn't it nice to not care what people think? Wasn't it a wonderful thing? You know, I can kind of remember when I used to care what people think. You know, I go, I think I've upset her. I don't know that she likes me. Now people, they say, well, Joy, you know, I don't think she likes you. I go, I hope that works out for her. It's a developmental stage. It's a wonderful, live with it, love it. So what prompts a person to say that? And my sense of things and my research says to me, the reason why people say things like, I don't even notice race, or even worse, this one, I don't really care what color people are. I mean, you could be purple, green, or blue. They can't even use real colors, that crew. They're so stressed out, they can't even use the real colors about it, right? And these are all, to me, symptoms of a greater pathology around race, right? And the pathology of race is our denial about it, right? And so I understand that these are the kinds of symptoms of folks that are experiencing cognitive dissonance. I used to wonder about this, you know, and my daughter who's working on her PhD right now, she calls what we experience, and some of you are familiar with, there's a wonderful film that Shakti Butler just finished, Cracking the Codes. And my daughter calls this experience we have, because you see, with most white people, it's unconscious. It's a lack of awareness or consciousness of the behavior. I think it was Stevie Wonder that said, you know, ain't it funny how you feel shows on your face? And what ends up happening is we experience what my daughter calls a subtle contempt. A subtle contempt. And the white person doesn't know that their body language has changed, don't know that they flushed red, don't know that their conversation changed when they saw you. They don't know what happened, you see, because of what I'm going to share with you today, because we've all been socialized in this big tank of pathology, and we reflect it every day. And you cannot fix what you don't understand. Post-traumatic slave syndrome not only affected African people, it is where the focus of my study is, it affected everyone. And I would, you know, really encourage you to search out and begin to look at the impact it has had on you and your community by virtue of vicarious racism. Vicarious racism. That you experience the racism of others. For example, if I were to ask you, and this is one of my weeding out the class questions, if I were to ask you, people in the audience, first of all, show of hands, how many of you think, don't be afraid, you have a grasp of what racism means? Show of hands. How many people think you know what racism is? Okay. How many of you in the audience believe, experience, know, or have some awareness of something called white racism? In other words, white people that have been racist. Show of hands. Okay, how many people, again, you're talking here about America, have an understanding, experience, or awareness of black racism? Show of hands. Okay, so now we're going to do basically work that through to kind of look at Joy's definition. So we're going to start with white racism. And I need for you to tell me the ways in which white racism has adversely impacted the lives of black people as an entire group of people here in this country. In what ways? Name them. Financially. So jobs, education, okay. Healthcare, incarceration, criminal justice, housing. Okay, you following me? We got it. And I usually write this on the board so nobody can get confused. So it's real clear. Now I need you to tell me how black racism adversely impacts the lives of white people as an entire group of people in this country. Now this is when the folks go, she's calling me a racist. Let me get my book. I'm out. They get mad, right? So it does not suggest that there aren't black people that are prejudiced, that in fact hate white people. Hate white people so much that they invite people over, put big pictures of white people on the wall and throw darts and drink beer. No doubt. They jump up and down and go, I hate you white people. They call out names, but you still get the loan. Are you following me? So it doesn't suggest that people don't like people, but not only do you not like me, but you have the power to impact an entire group of people with that dislike. That's the difference. So when we begin to have a conversation about this, do you see? And why it is that people get all twisted around it as though someone's trying to assault them. This was set up long before any of us showed up in this room. This was set up a long time ago. But we need to get clear about it so we don't get caught up in the game. And we get caught up in the game because, again, I love Peggy McIntosh, a really good friend, and who truly is an advocate, fierce warrior woman out there. But Peggy will say, but we're nice, right? And you see, again, those are the things that produce dissonance. So cognitive dissonance is when a person is faced with contradictory information internally, simultaneously holding contradictory ideas and beliefs, and trying to ferret through them, because we don't deal well with holding on to contradictory beliefs, thoughts, actions, or ideologies. We've got to somehow balance that out. So my first question was, how was it that Europeans were able to oppress and subjugate an entire group of people, and using the figures from our text, incorrect though they be, from 1619 to the ratification of the 13th Amendment, which would make that 246 years. How did white people who deem themselves superior, intelligent, civilized, noble, and moral engage in behaviors for 246 years that are the antithesis of that? How did they reconcile the dissonance? Because it clearly had to produce dissonance. Right? So that was my fundamental question. How did you do that? So one of the things that we have to understand that jumps out is the first fundamental contradiction of this country was the notion of freedom and democracy. That's called call and response. Don't nobody get upset. Don't, you know. I just want y'all to know that that's what happens. It's what we do. You know, I don't want anybody in the audience that's not familiar with that behavior. Okay, so you have this idea of freedom and democracy, a constitution and basically a moral construct that says, send us your poor, your tired, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. How does one breathe those statements and at the exact same time be committing genocide against native people, the rightful people of this country, and then imprisoning enslaving, beating, selling, maiming African people for 246 years. How does one reconcile it with those beliefs? Because you see, that produces cognitive dissonance. So the way you can resolve cognitive dissonance as it relates to oppressing or subjugating entire groups of people, and you'll see this throughout this presentation, and when you leave here, you'll see it in the media, you'll see it demonstrated everywhere you need to make people feel okay about crazy stuff. What you have to first do is justify the behavior. Because you see, when you can justify the behavior, you can calm the conscience. Well, I'm justified in this. Well, then you have to justify this by somehow proving that what you're doing is correct and right. And you do that by relabeling the people you are oppressing or subjugating to fit your behavior towards them. And this is how you relieve any guilt or any, you know, any kind of animosity, fear, anxiety, dissonance. So when we look through, we also know throughout our history that we had a trail of tears. Something we should never forget, the suffering of Native people, forced relocation. These numbers are not correct. There are actually more people died than the 4,000 identified here. We also know that there were some who attempted, although weak and pathetically, to offer reparations, $250 million in funds to redress the problem because of some of the policies that were enacted against Native people and their children. And of course, Native people laughed out loud, at which they should, because you cannot redress the injury to that culture. And I'm gonna go back to a slide I want you to see. I skipped it earlier. This is a slide, James Gilligan, who's a psychiatrist, wrote a book called Violence. And in this book, he turns into an activist about halfway through the book, because he's clinical for the most part in the first part of the book, talking about, you know, why people are violent and this sort of thing. But then he eventually says that the real cause is the destruction of culture. And he's talking principally about black and brown men. He talked about a system that systematically destroys the culture and thus the person, robbing them of their whole selves. And that it is the destruction of the culture that is tantamount to the destruction of the self. So when we look at these atrocities, we look at the Trail of Tears, we are reminded again of the horrific nature of assaulting a person's character. Well, this is another photo I took when I was in Ghana. And this is the door of no return at Elmina Slave Castle. And we also had a trail of sorrow that you never read about, nor did you hear about. Because you see, we didn't all live on the coast. We were marched to the coast. And sometimes we were marched as far as the interiors of Africa to that coast. And millions died en route. But you never heard about them, did you? And part of what I did was, you know, in an effort to try to get a sense of myself, my family, we did the swab, the little swab. And so, which I believe, by the way, the United States should give that freely to every person of African descent. I shouldn't have had to pay for that because I was robbed of that, you see. And so we did the swab and indeed found out that my family was from the west coast of Africa, and we're doing further tests so I can maybe even stand in the spot that my people came from. But what's interesting is what happened when they sent me back my little information, which was way more information than I understood, because I went through gene-based, you know, these are genetic folks that are sending you all haplogroups and charts. And so when I got my information, I wanted to be able to articulate it intelligently, so I called them, and they're really good about that. They'll talk to you however many times you call. They'll pull up your information. And so I called, and the gentleman that answered the phone was Chinese. Now, I didn't know that at first, but he was talking to me, and I said, I need for you to explain what I'm looking at here. He says, okay. He says, so what are you looking at? I said, I'm looking at this big map. He says, okay, I have it up. I said, you see on the map the big giant kind of arrow? He goes, yeah. I said, now, are my people from where the arrow is starting, are my people from where the arrow is pointing? And he said, sweetheart, we are all from where that arrow starts. He says, I am Chinese, and trust me, Chinese people are even now trying to find out if they came from somewhere else because they don't want to be from the same place anybody else has been from. He said, Chinese people are trying to find their own genetic markers anywhere else in the world because they don't want to be with anybody. He says, but trust me, based on mitochondrial DNA, this is where we all started, regardless of where we eventually migrated to. So now that I'm speaking to all you Africans, when I started to look at the experience of my ancestors, and again, I don't say that in any way other than the absolute truth. I know for a fact they were my ancestors. Cape Coast Slave Castle, I understand that recently some folks have gone, they tried to clean it up. They might have heard about my presentation. Anyway, they, when you first go into this particular dungeon, this castle, you see two dungeons, male, female. And we had the bounty of having a scholar be a part of our journey. And so the scholar was explaining to us that they would often rape the women and the girls within 50 feet of the men, immediately, right in front of their fathers, their sons, their brothers, their husbands, right in front of them. For two reasons, to remind them that this man cannot help you, that this man has been totally emasculated, and that if you do not do what we want you to do, we will destroy you. And so it's immediate, though. So you have to understand this is conscious. So they then took us to the male slave dungeon. Understand, there was no lights. Okay, there's a light bulb hanging there, but there are no lights. There were no lights then. So they tell you a little bit, and how many people have been? Okay. So one of the things that strikes you about being in those dungeons, the first thing that hits you, it's a very creepy feeling because it's damp, it's slippery because the floors are on a slant, and they're deliberately made on a slant because they actually all lead to a little trench because there's no running water, no facilities. So all the waste kind of slides down. So what hits you first is this horrible smell. The dampness, the slippery floors, and then they tell you, and they warn you first. They say, we're going to turn the lights out, but only for a few seconds. But we want to warn you because it's going to feel a little bad for you. So they turn off the lights, and this is the only source of light and ventilation for hundreds of people packed together with no running water, no facilities. And some of them will remain in these particular dungeons upward of a year. So then they you know, again, show us another piece of information here. This is a death cell. You know, it's so striking. When I snapped this picture, I remember looking at, it's a very ominous kind of feeling you get because this is, it's a death cell. It means that when you go in there, you're not coming out. And this is what would happen for African men. These were the brothers that fought back. They said, I'm not having it. Okay, that's just what happened to them. And when they put them in there, the only source of light and ventilation are the holes in the door. So they stopped giving them water and food, and they would literally thirst to death and suffocate. And inside these cells, and you also go in and they shut the door so you can feel what that feels like. And here on the floor, you can see carved into almost solid stone are African, ancient African symbols calling out to the ancestors to please deliver them, to come to take them. Next door is the cell for white soldiers where they are held no longer than 24 hours. Notice the big square window here and the latticed door, another window the same size. Again, really helping you to understand the point at which you become, the dehumanization begins. This is where I had a bit of a meltdown. This is these are stairs leading from the female slave dungeon directly into the bedroom of the governor, where he lived with his wife and family. He had it built so he could have free access to girls and women. This is a steel ball that enslaved women were chained to who resisted being raped. They were also no longer given food or water, and they're chained in the middle of the courtyard naked. Another form of death cell was this, much like a hole, a pit that they were put in, where they would almost bake in this particular cell. Here is one of the dungeons where UNESCO, when they were trying to clear out this particular dungeon to make it tourable, essentially they were cleaning it and making it, you know, trying to level the floor, and the workers couldn't understand why they couldn't get the floor leveled, and then they realized they were trying to break through not dirt, but solidified human waste, 2 feet of it. So what we know is two things. One is people wallowed in 2 feet of waste, and they never bothered to remove it. And, well, here we go. Right in the middle of it all was a church. And this church was placed here for the soldiers and their families so that they could have a place to worship. What would Jesus say? Okay, so this particular photo, one that you're familiar with, but which is pretty, it disturbs me. And the reason why it disturbs me is it's peculiarly absent of any feeling. You see, these are people. And this is a slave ship showing how many people were packed together like sardines. And they were packed because you see their cargo. And they overpacked it because they assume, like any other cargo, some will spoil. And in this case, that would mean what? It means death. So let's put it in perspective, but anywhere between 18 to 24 inches of space. People were chained together for weeks to months. And in this space is where they ate, it is where they slept, it is where they wept, it is where they defecated, it is where they urinated, it is where they menstruated, it is where they vomited, it is where some gave birth and died. 18 to 24 inches of space between them. The lowest figure we have on record of those that died during the Middle Passage, and we know it's low because someone white came up with the figure. The lowest figure we have is 9 million. That's the lowest one. Who died en route. And the reason why so many died was because of these conditions, and more importantly, when there was an outbreak of disease, because remember, people are chained together. Outbreak of typhoid or yellow fever, rather than do anything to help the people, they would abandon the ship and leave the people chained below. That's why so many died. I was able to actually find original pictures of slave ships. This one you cannot see well, but to your right is, those are people, and there's so many people when they would bring them up on top to throw salt water on them occasionally. There's so many people that you can't see the deck of the ship. And on the other side are the shackles to show you how the shackles are arranged to see how close together they are. We also know that in 2008 and 2009, the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate actually apologized for slavery officially. Did you know that? Isn't that interesting? It's very interesting that nobody seems to know this. I would, you know, in my class, I have the entire apology together with the whereases and all of the little statements that go with it. Very long document. But you didn't hear about it. And I think that's curious, don't you think? It's a pretty big deal, don't you think? Not only did you not know, the average black person didn't know. And they apologized twice. In 2008, and then again in 2009. Did they just remember? The reason why they apologized in 2008, because it marked the 200th anniversary of the end of the slave trade in America. This was a huge, huge anniversary. If you don't think so, I was called to Europe in 2007, where I do work there, because the Prime Minister had opened up the entire country and asked scholars to come through, had presentations, honoring ceremonies, remembrance ceremonies, prayers, all of this, because they were commemorating the 200th anniversary in 2007 of the end of the slave trade in Europe. Well, the United States had to do something. So they issued an apology which no one saw. It wasn't covered by CNN. It wasn't a huge coverage by any of the major networks. Why? Because then you'd have to explain something to Cindy and Timmy. It would produce cognitive dissonance. Because let's see how much they knew, you whining black people, you. They acknowledged the injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of slavery and Jim Crow. The resolution states that the vestiges of Jim Crow continue to this day. African Americans continue to suffer from the consequences of slavery and Jim Crow long after both systems were formally abolished. How? Through enormous damage and loss, both tangible and intangible, including the loss of human dignity and liberty, the frustration of careers and professional lives, and the long-term loss of income and opportunity. They knew. And then dared you to mention it. Dared you to mention it. Knew, always have known. And then we go, well, let's go with that little, the question, that the statement, the student. But you all own slaves. Let's get real up close and personal with that one. In fact, not only did black people, Africans own slaves, almost every major culture in the world owned slaves. In fact, the majority of slavery existed as a result of war. Two societies would go to war. Winners would enslave the losers. Sometimes in a case like Rome, you have a more dominant society that makes war so they can get more manpower. Europeans, however, systematically turned the capturing, shipping, and selling of other human beings into a business. A business that would develop into the backbone of an entire economy. American chattel slavery differed in fundamental ways from every form of slavery that existed prior. It differed in the manner in which a person became enslaved. It differed in the length of servitude. It differed in the treatment of the enslaved. But most of all, it differed in the way people even presumed or viewed their slaves. That's different. You cannot compare it. When you start looking at slavery, people eventually, they had children born free. They became part of the culture. They adopted the religion. They became citizens. Black people were never intended to be citizens, and I can prove that. So here is where we start getting into the people who get all squeamish and go, but what about women? But what about? Because you see, this is what happens when people feel dissonance. They start going, well, because it feels so uncomfortable to talk so much about this. Let's talk about other groups. This is a wonderful book written called Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. You see, that's different than oppression. That's different than simply looking at someone and going, well, you know, we're gonna use you. We might even take and exploit you. But when we dehumanize you, you become less than human. That's different. That's not what Africans did to other Africans. And so when we begin to look at the European slave trade, we are looking at something far, far different from anything we've seen. In fact, it would be considered a crime against humanity based on the International Criminal Court. And let's be clear about something. And I respect this about Jewish people. Because see, Jewish people, they don't care what you think about their Holocaust. They don't care what you think. Because they're going to tell their children, and they're going to tell their children, and they're going to tell their children. And if nobody gets it, Spielberg will make another movie, so you will know. In addition to that, if right now, 2013, today, you find someone floating around in San Francisco that had any inkling of a connection with Nazis, they gonna drag his behind in court on life support and take him down. Are we clear? I'm not making that up. I don't care what, get his oxygen, whatever, roll him up in the bed. But he's going down today because they're not playing. So when we start looking at these issues, it's always the rule changes when you're talking about black folks. The rule changes. Somehow our humanity doesn't measure up.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kbu.fm. The time is 8 o'clock. Stay tuned for Ear to the Streets of Portland for music coming up after this. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. From our hands to yours, celebrating 43 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday.